So we're going to take up case 11 today of the Shoyoroku, which is the Book of Serenity, called Unman's Four Sicknesses. Unman Daishi said, "There are two sicknesses that prevent the light from penetrating. One sickness is where everything is unclear and something seems to hang before you. Therefore, the light does not penetrate. The second sickness is where you have realized that everything is void, but still you feel you are in the mists. Therefore, the light does not penetrate thoroughly. The third sickness is about the Dharmakaya. There are also two sicknesses here. The third one is if you reach the Dharma, but fall and remain there and do not extinguish your own opinion about it, that too is a sickness. The fourth one is if you think you can give up efforts after enlightenment and minutely examine your own consciousness and find there is no blemish or no scar, that too is a sickness." Please sit comfortably. So Yunmen said, there are two sicknesses that prevent the light from penetrating. The first sickness is where everything is unclear and something seems to hang before the eyes. Therefore, the light does not penetrate. So this first sickness is our most common disposition, the common ordinary state of mind that most students struggle with, where our mind is dull, a kind of ignorant or lacking in clarity, and there are obstacles that block our vision, our wisdom, and they prevent the light from penetrating deeply. So no matter what our background or what kind of skills and resources you have, as we walk through life's journey, somewhere along the way, we encounter a wounding. And it may be just a small splinter that lodges in the heart, but continues to irritate us until we are forced to give it our attention. Or it may feel like our life has been shaped by anguish or loneliness, and problems in the family and despair at times. And there is often a core issue in our life that usually involves some deep wounding or some major reoccurring dilemma. It may be an affair that we regret that brought us lots of pain. Or perhaps we have two loves that we just can't reconcile and we don't know which one to choose. Or we have that sort of ongoing sense that we don't get our needs met in a relationship. And this keeps reoccurring over and over in many relationships. Or that there is a lack of self-confidence and low self-esteem that keeps bubbling up no matter what happens in your life. Or you never quite find your true work in the world. Or perhaps it's the opposite, you have too much work in the world and pressure and responsibility, and then you forget how to play and take time out. Yeah. So all of us have some kind of deep wounding. For some of us, at our age, for many people here, in fact, it's kind of dealing with aging and dying parents. Yeah, I'm one of those too. And the kind of struggles and difficulties that brings up. Yeah. And so it may be some deep hurt or regret that we have never quite healed, perhaps. So we are all afflicted in some way, and this wounding takes on a variety of forms. And it usually emerges in the first or second day in session. And this wounding is called the first noble truth in Buddhism, that there is suffering in life, and it hangs before us. Yeah? It hangs before the eyes. So some of our wounds become scars, and we become strong in the broken places. But some of our wounds seem so deep that the healing is very slow and a kind of glacial-like in its progress of healing. Some wounds are kind of layered, multi-layered, and the purification process too is deep and slow. And it may take many years of practice to finally resolve some of these deep core issues. At other times, the wound is so close to the surface, it gets activated so easily, you know, it's like there's just this thin membrane over some kind of deep pain. And someone touches that, even accidentally, and we kind of lash out and bite them, you know. Like a dog that has a kind of sore, you know, on the top of its head, and you don't know that it's there, and you go to pat, nice dog. And you accidentally touch that sore, that pain, and the dog just kind of goes, you know, growls and snaps at you. And normally it's a kind and friendly, lovely animal, you know. But it can't help itself when we're touched in that painful place sometimes. So we all, you know, need certain kind of healing with our wounds, and there's kind of skillful ways to deal with this and not so skillful ways, and we all need a bit of guidance in how to work with this kind of familiar old stuff, particularly that comes up again and again, that keeps emerging in our practice. And we need to be able in some ways to turn towards it and face that pain and work with it directly. And so one of the easiest ways to do this is to notice, how is that manifesting in your body? How is that loneliness or fear or anger or hurt or whatever it is, or regret or anguish, where is that? How is that manifesting in your body? And then using your awareness and compassionate kind of loving awareness, direct that into the body. Work with that directly, yeah. Steadily, kind of bring that compassionate attention to those very pains, that psychological and emotional pains. And so bring your awareness to that and keep breathing through it. Keep breathing compassionately through that stuff, yeah. And there's a fine line here, because it does not mean wallowing in that hole yet again. You know, we've been there for aeons, you know, we don't need to keep going back there in some sense, you know. Wallowing it in is the kind of woe is me stuff, is poor me, how hard done by am I, and all of that, how we can easily fall into that, you know, the poor me victim stuff. Well, and on the other hand, we don't want to let this emotional stuff and our wounds dominate our life and drive us either. Yeah. So we don't want to, in some sense, over-amplify it, and other times we don't want to suppress it. So we have to be very careful when we're working with this old deep stuff that we actually have a steady awareness that meets that energy. Yeah. Without that movement of the mind, without repression, and without amplification, and without wallowing, yeah? So it's a kind of steady, compassionate awareness that you bring to those old wounds, and that gets transformed and healed in that place, in that spirit. You start to accept it and open to it, and not judge it, and don't add anything further to it. Then it has its own momentum and its own kind of life. Yeah, and it will pass too. In the miscellaneous koans, we have a kind of interesting koan. It's also about, we study it on two different levels, but it's about our relationship to suffering too. And the koan is, even though you can plunge into the sea and count all the sands of the Ganges, how is it that you are sitting on top of a needle? Kind of a strange con, huh? How is it that you are sitting on top of a needle? So at the character level of this con, some of the cons have an interesting kind of character side to them. The needle here is symbolic for the suffering in our life. So the con is asking us, well, how do you sit with that suffering and pain in your life? Yeah. How do you deal with that suffering? What is your relationship to that suffering, to that point of the needle? And the point of the needle in my life is being a householder with, you know, with three teenage boys at home. I'm a stepmother to my partner's two children and my son who's 16. So we have three teenagers, all going to three different schools. So we have one, what you call a kind of blended family nightmare. kind of very interesting, dynamic, chaotic mix. And, you know, that's the point of the needle for me, is dealing with that and how to kind of respond to teenage boys, you know, who are very gung-ho and kind of trying to navigate through drugs and sex and rock and roll. It's not rock and roll, it's hip-hop now or whatever it is. and all of that stuff that comes up, you know, every weekend. And how to navigate a safe passage through that. Because, you know, my partner and I don't indulge in alcohol and drugs, you know, and so we're seen as really, really old-fashioned and just totally out of sync with the rest of the world, you know. So, it's an interesting process, you know, how to do that skillfully without kind of being purist or on any of that. So, you know, kind of share my drug history too with them. So the way we usually relate to our suffering, to our wound or obstacles, is that we want it to go away. We want to avoid it. We want to dismiss it or deny it or hope the hell it's not going to come back. Well, denial doesn't allow the wound to be healed. It does not bring it out into the open. Allow the light to penetrate. Does not allow the light into the wound. At least a lot of us are here because we are suffering and we know it. And we are here to, in some ways, resolve some of those things. Whatever your wound or difficulty, we need to honor it and work with it and learn from it and transform it and heal it, face it and bring attention to it. And then we find an interesting thing as we do this, that we discover too that there's a deeper truth in there as we face that suffering, that the truth too holds a deeper layer. The truth also exists in whatever condition, whatever pain, whatever situation we are in. If we go deeply enough into that, see into that moment, then Buddha nature is right there too, at the very point of the needle of your life. So the fundamental wound virtually is the same for all of us. We have all our personal little wounds, but there is a fundamental wound of humanity that we all struggle with. And this is the sense that I am separate and you are out there. That we have some notion of I being a permanent, separate entity. And I here and the world out there, this subject-object experience is the fundamental delusion. This is the object that hangs before us. This fundamental split, this dualistic notion, is the root cause of much of our dis-ease and suffering. So your practice allows you to loosen your grip and see clearly that which feeds the suffering in your life. And usually this is about attachments and fears that we hang on to, or we scare ourselves about all kinds of manner of things, projections and opinions that we continually construct, about ourselves and others and how this constricts our reality. These are the prisons that we create by our mind, by our particular view of reality. With the light of attention and faithfulness to observing the way of things, then the great way opens up naturally of itself, and things start to soften and dissolve. So what are the obstacles that hang before you at this time in your practice? Yun Men said, the second sickness is where you have realized that everything is void, but still you feel you are in the midst. Therefore, the light does not penetrate thoroughly. Yun Men is signaling here that there's also a sickness, a delusion, that occurs after realization, after insight. Our initial insight experience is only the beginning of a long process of integration and application of our understanding. Even when you have some insight, perhaps, an eye or a moment into the empty field or the vastness at the core of your being, and the small sense of the self drops away. And there is some understanding there, yet it is not the full understanding. It is like one eye has opened, but there is not yet the fullness of vision. It's easy at this point, when we've all had our little kind of insights or understandings along the way, to get attached to our insight, to attach to our experience. And we kind of want to recreate that, those beautiful, lovely moments, You might have had a blissful moment or a special insight, an opening experience. And we want to cling onto that, and somehow our practice for some years can be trying to get back to that experience, or if only I could kind of have that experience again, And that very clinging is the barrier, is the obstacle that hangs before you. It's trying to cling onto something there, And so even those who have some understanding of emptiness and the void, can be a clinging on to this kind of emptiness, that experience of emptiness. And that becomes the mist, that becomes the fog again. And that hangs before us, and we can get stuck there. And that is what Yun Men is warning us about. As Yamada Roshi said, full realization is the empty oneness, the empty fullness of all things. This is a story about Master Chang Sa and Brother Hu, which reiterates Yun Men's point here about getting stuck in the kind of insight experience or hanging on to that. Chang Sa and the monk Hu trained together under Nan Chuan. In due time, these two brother monks became independent. Chang Sa became abbot of a large training center. Hu went to live in a hermitage in the mountains. How is Brother Hu getting along these days? Chang Sa wondered. So he sent a monk to call upon him with instructions about what to say. Brother monks always check each other out and always testing each other. That competition never dies, does it? Another barrier. Oh. So the monk arrived and asked Brother Hu, "What about when you had not met Nan Chuan? What about before you had met Nan Chuan, our teacher? It's like, what is your understanding there?" Hu sat quietly. Didn't say anything. Just sat quietly. So the monk asked, "What about after you met Nan Chuan?" What about after you, truly met Nan Chuan? What about after you had some insight, realization? What then? And Hu said, "Nothing special." So the monk returned to Chang Sa and told him what had happened. And Chang Sa said this famous verse, "You who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, it is not yet genuine. Take a step from the top of that pole, and the worlds of the 10 directions are your total body." So it's a kind of interesting story here. Chang Sa is kind of responding to Brother Hu and saying, "Well, I think your nothing special is a bit stuck," basically. You're stuck on that 100-foot pole there. So how do we step from that 100-foot pole? Well, it's really simply a process of letting go. And in fact, meditation is always a process of letting go. Yeah. And I remember a student who was working with this case, and he said, I create hundreds of 100-foot poles all over the place, all the time. I create them with my mind. I'm always trying to step off this pole. Yeah. And he was kind of very humorous about it. And it's true. We create these kind of 100-foot poles for ourselves in a way, you know, and we get stuck in all kinds of places in our practice, in our lives. But when we do step forth into this vast field, yeah, the wind and the stones and the clouds, and each thing enters us, each thing comes forth. It is opening the door of the mind wide and letting everything enter. Yeah. And so then the call of the bird alone in the forest at dawn awakens the lonely heart to its true voice. And so stepping from the 100-foot pole is also actualizing the way, yeah, bringing it home into our daily life, not some kind of rarefied state of insight up there on the 100-foot pole, but bringing it down into your life, living it fully. It's about opening and softening the heart of compassion to meet and greet each thing as Buddha, as Mu, every moment. So the third sickness, in the Dharmakaya, there are also two sicknesses, he said. Yunmen warns us that if you reach the Dharma, fall and remain there and do not extinguish your own opinion about it, this too is a sickness. Well, the Dharmakaya is the essential world. Yunmen is warning us again how easy it is to form and to hang on to opinions and views about truth, about enlightenment, about reality, and about the Dharma itself. And there are many views that have been propagated, the Mahayana, the Theravada, the thousands of years we have various views about the Dharma and how people hang on, yeah, religiously to their views of the one pure right path. So, to form subtle views about reality, views about our own experience or insight, that too is a sickness. Be aware. So the Buddha made no mistake when he put right view as number one on the Eightfold Noble Path, because it is both subtle and profound. And I found this in the mid-length sayings, and I thought it was very interesting. The Buddha said there are six speculative false views. The first one is, false view, is that the self exists. Second false view is no self exists. Third one is I perceive self with self. Fourth one, I perceive not self with self. And the fifth one, I perceive self with not self. The sixth one is, this is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there. This is the result of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, and eternal. That, too, is a false view. So Yunmen is recommending, yeah, wipe away all of those false views. Wipe away those subtle traces of I have attained enlightenment. Or you're hanging on to not-self. Then this no trace continues endlessly, and this no trace is simply the nature of the mind, right where we stand. The last one, the fourth sickness, is also very subtle and refined. It says, if you think you can give up efforts after enlightenment, And if you minutely examine your own consciousness and find there is no blemish, no scar, that too is a sickness. So this sickness is the subtle clinging to the pure and clear Dharmakaya vision of perfection and relishing in that clarity of samadhi. The third or fourth day, and you know, come into session, people's eyes clear up, their mind gets more focused, and we kind of get these lovely kind of moments even of samadhi and clarity of mind, and we can relish and cling to that. Yeah. And the image here that Yunmen gives is the image of the mind is like a pure white silk, yeah, very refined and clear. And some students, even with a little bit of insight, can be more dangerous than no insight sometimes. But with a little insight, they believe there is nothing to do, nothing to attain, that they don't need to make an effort any longer. Yeah. So they've had some insight, yeah. And it's kind of literalizing non-doing. Yeah. Certain schools kind of think, they sort of open up the mind and then they just think, oh yeah, it's all here, you don't have to do anything about it, you know, and it's kind of this, then they don't do anything about it. And they wonder why that kind of mind closes over and they lose that insight. You may have spent also many years purifying the heart and body and mind, and you may have gained some degree of insight, but to believe that there is also no flaw in the mirror mind, this too is a delusion. To believe that the mind is pure and clear, pristine clarity, yeah, the mirror mind, this is a problem. And I'll share a personal story with you about this. And some time back, up in Lismore, a lovely teacher, wonderful teacher called Gangaji came to town. Gangaji is a Vedanta teacher and a really beautiful and wise, kind of dynamic, charismatic guru type. Yeah. And so I was wondering, you know, I was thinking, oh, whether I go and sit with Gangaji or kind of visit Gangaji, you know, sort of partly thinking about it, because everybody, you know, in Byron Bay, it's like a spiritual supermarket. The latest guru comes to town, everyone trots down to check out the latest guru, you know, that kind of thing. This is great and it's lively and interesting, you know. So I was kind of thinking about this and I thought, well, if I have a dream, you know, maybe I'll go and visit Gangaji. We'll see. And so that night I had a dream about sitting in a circle chatting, you know, with Dharma friends, with Gangaji. And I thought, okay, yeah. And then the very next day, the organizers for Gangaji's big kind of tour rang up and said, oh, you know, Gangaji would like to invite you, you know, would you like to come down and meet Gangaji? And I said, okay, yeah. And it so happened that Hogan-san was, you know, Zen Master Hogan, who's also another dear friend and Dharma cousin kind of to our lineage. He was also in town and I said, oh, well, you know, maybe Zen Master Hogan would like to come along too. So, you know, they rang up Hogan and we all went down to meet, the two of us went down to meet Gangaji. So Gangaji had been giving this big sort of satsang, you know, in this place, and there she was on the white couch and and the flowers and, you know, these gorgeous pictures of Ramana Maharshi and Papaji and the whole guru scene, you know, that's very, very interesting. And so after all of that, we met with Gangaji in the back room. And there was just the three of us and lots of ears hanging out sort of through the cracks in the walls and the windows and trying to tape the session and everything. And anyway, it was a kind of interesting meeting. And just as we're doing introductions, right from the very first moment, it was like, okay, this is on, you know, it's like... Gangaji, just we're doing the introductions, and Hogan walks in, and she says, "Oh, Zen Master Hogan." She goes up to kind of greet him and, you know, give him, shake his hand. And he says, "Oh, no, 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 I'm just a simple monk." Yeah. And she, Gangaji turns to me and says, "Is this Zen Master Hogan? You know, who is this person?" And I just smiled and laughed, and, you know, she realized then that it was just his humble response. She's the great guru and he's the humble monk, you know. And it's, so this is the kind of meeting, you know, there's the kind of... So we sit down at this little round table, and there's quite... I'll just shorten the conversation. But Gangaji at one point says, "The truth is empty and perfect, just as it is." And Hogan said, "Oh, no, it's not." And then Hogan said, "So you are saying there is no flaw in the mirror of the mind, no scar?" Mm. And Gangaji said, "There is no flaw. Yeah? It is pure and clear, and is nothing there." And I said, I don't agree. If you think there's no flaw in the mirror of the mind, then that is delusion. And Hogan said, he and I were kind of on the same wavelength. I think we've studied. I think we both studied the same case, Yuen Men's case here. So Hogan, we're sitting at this round table, and there's, you know, it's made of pine, just like this floor, and there's a kind of crack in the round polished table, you know, just like this floor has knots and kind of, you know, patterns in the grain of the wood, and he pointed to the floor in the crack in the table where we are sitting, and he said, "Just like the wood grain has a crack and the floors are a natural part of the wood and the table, so too are the floors in our humanity a natural part of the mirror of the mind. They are not separate." And until we are fully realized, he said, we must be vigilant to the very last breath, to our cultural flaws and conditioning. We must be vigilant to the last breath. Yeah. And so I asked Hogan, I said, what are you referring to, Hogan? And because I was kind of, you know, I knew that he was kind of getting at something here, other than just challenging Gangaji. Yeah. He was referring to Zen teachers in Japan in the Second World War, who had ended up supporting the war and violating the first precept, which is in the Buddhist tradition to refrain from killing. And they had ended up supporting the war and the whole Japanese propaganda and indoctrination, you know, and cultural ideology, and all of their conditioning sort of was present. So they had ended up being swept up by that and supporting the war, Second World War. And he said how difficult it is to step outside one's cultural ideologies and our values, particularly if it goes against the norm of the culture at the time. Yeah. And this is true too, and we've seen this here in Australia in the response to refugees and also in the response to the war in Iraq, how easy it is to get swept up and justify those things, you know. And I think we also need to have a little bit of compassion here for many of the priests, the Zen priests and monks who did, in fact, support the war, the Second World War, you know, because those who didn't, and there were a few who didn't, and they spoke out against it in protest, yeah, and they were shot, yeah, and or imprisoned for life and died. So it was no small thing to stand up against that, yeah. And I wonder if any of us would, yeah, if it meant death, the death penalty. So this is a poem here by Cheng Sha that also reiterates this same point about not clinging to that pure, clear samadhi mind. Yeah. Or maybe before I do that, I'll tell you another little story. My own personal experience around this was, this is about clinging to a pure, clear, kind of deep samadhi mind, yeah. which of course I love, and I love to cling to that too. this is the time when, some years back, and I was very sick with the flu, and had the flu for about 2 weeks. And I'd got on a at the end of that time, I was heading over to meet John Tarrant, my teacher in the States. And so I was sick, and I flew over to kind of enter into Sesshin and assist him on Sesshin. And so I arrived in California, in San Francisco, and I was jet-lagged, and I was sick, and I was tired, and I was complaining, and I didn't really want to go to Sesshin. The whole thing was sort of like, you know, don't really want to be here. So I was feeling sorry for myself and a bit miserable at the time. And so John picks me up from the airport, and we're driving to the Redwoods, where, I've forgotten the place where Sesshin was, but this beautiful place. And we're hurtling down the freeway, you know, at 100 kilometers an hour. And John says, right, let's get to work. And I'm just going, no, I don't want to answer any koans right now, John. I'm tired, I'm sick, you know, I'm jet-lagged, you know. I can't answer koans, you know. I have to, you know, be in Sesshin, you know. Because the only time I ever used to work with koans is virtually in Sesshin. And, you know, then I'd kind of get into this nice samadhi, clarity of mind, and that kind of things would come easily and clearly at that time. So, you know, I was kind of saying, oh, no, I can't do that. And then he turned around while we were in the car, hurtling down the freeway, and he said, if you cannot answer koans, if you cannot have this insight right here and now at 100 kilometers an hour down a freeway in your daily life, then all your years of practice are for nothing. Scolded me kindly. Yeah. That was a good scolding, I might add, because it really stopped me in my tracks. And I thought, oh, okay. So he just continued to fire koans at me, yeah. And so then I realized that I could answer them, that I didn't need to be in the kind of deep samadhi space in order to be clear, yeah.